Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 99, Exploring the Kali Chakra.
Tibetan singer gave it to us, coming tomorrow to sing, friend of ours. He's some Tibetan had the vision of His Holiness, his face in the moon, and he made these t-shirts. Then he's in prison now by the Chinese police. Somewhere in Tibet, nobody knows his fate. You know, it's like a sad thing. It's a sad side to the story. So he told me not to wear it and show the Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama knows the story about the arrest and disappearance of the guy who manufactured them. From a vision he had, you know. Usually the Buddhists they don't have an old man in the moon. They have a bodhisattva bunny rabbit. It was drawn by the god Indra to commemorate the bodhisattva when he was a bunny rabbit, who offered his body to a wandering traveler, for bunny burgers. In a competition with the other animals as to who could be the nicest to the traveler, and the traveler actually was the god Indra in disguise, and he revealed himself then and rewarded the bunny rabbit. I don't know if he reincarnated him or what.
Yeah, you're
Why don't we just put it on the table?
Well, as long as it doesn't pull off.
As long as I don't get excited and knock it over.
Doesn't give you a lot of.
What? It'll mess up the recording?
No, it's not recording. He's recording here.
Oh, okay. Okay. Does it work? Is it working?
Let me turn it up a little bit. Try it again.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, 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 hello. Is that amplifying a little bit? Hello, hello, hello.
Is that good back there?
Can you hear it easily? That's nice.
Okay. You know what, Bob? I think maybe I'll do this fast. How about over here?
When did you get the tattoo?
I got that in Boulder, actually.
How long ago?
A few years ago.
Sweet.
After 45 years of marriage, I got a tattoo with the Nina's name on it. Somebody who was a tattoo guy said, oh, would you want to, showing off somebody else's tattoo. I said, that's a nice tattoo. Had his wife's name on the tattoo. And then they said, you want one? And then they said, it doesn't hurt much. And after a lecture I gave, like at midnight or something, then they did that. And then the kids really like it. They went, that's awesome. I did it before our anniversary party. And she said, what did you do that for? She has one on her ankle in response.
With your name, Bob?
No, it just has a T on it.
Oh.
Could be Tom. Tenzin. Who knows? You never know. Okay, so we're back to preparation for the great event. And, the reason that His Holiness was... Actually, His Holiness didn't say that this time. I didn't hear it. I have a funny way of listening. I put the earphone with the translation in one ear and I listen to the Tibetan with the other one. It gives me an immediate check on the translator. But then sometimes when it goes static and then I get distracted and I miss things in whatever language. Actually, the most assiduous translator of the 11 languages that are being translated, everything's being translated, is the Chinese guy. He's right on top of it at all times. He has the best channel. There's no static. It's impressive, really. It's really great. So, someone has jewels on their iPhone. My goodness. That's very fashionable. So, he always tells people that really it's very difficult. He's very self-deprecating, and he says, like an honest teacher, and he says that Is that really working down there?
Yeah.
He says that he's not qualified to really give this initiation. He thinks almost everyone in the room, in the vast host, is not qualified to receive it. And he does it as a blessing. And for the others, you know. And then, which is really wonderful. Of course, he's highly qualified to give it. He's the most qualified person on the planet. And maybe for several centuries to give that particular initiation. And there may be a few yogis out of 100,000 who are really seriously interested in it. But he says he offers the initiation because people will come for the initiation. They won't come for a lecture on Nagarjuna. So he says, I tricked you, and this is the important thing, what I'm telling you now. He says he didn't say that this time, but. And what he did today was what the Tibetans call a lung, which means that really he almost just read most of the text, which is a wonder. Now, the second text is not so important and well known, although by chance, it's the first Tibetan book I ever read, with the exact commentary by Rendawa, who is a Sakyapa. And my teacher read it to me. The excuse was that I would be learning the language in his reading it. So he would read me a section, and then I would look it up in the dictionary and study the grammar of it, etc. And I was so, at 21, I was so determined to learn the Dharma at that point that, I really, really, I spent all the time I wasn't learning from him studying it. And I became fluent in Tibetan in 10 weeks. It was like amazed. They were all amazed. And I was annoying everybody, debating with them in Tibetan. He ordered me not to debate with people. He said I made them too unhappy. But anyway, I read that book. And it's a marvelous book, the short one, the one called Letter to the King. It's the long one, the first one he was reading, is also to the king, but it's more like a text, 500 verses. And it's really one of his great works, Nagarjuna. It's the most wonderful social teachings. No capital punishment, 200 BC, CE, 200 to 150 CE, second century. And he explains the reasons why capital punishment is no good. He teaches, the social thing that he teaches is just totally marvelous. But anyway, he just chose those works. What the real preparation for Tantra involves kind of a whole view of life, actually, which probably some of you have. How many of you think you had a previous life and will have a future life? How many of you actually think so? Well, quite a lot of you, actually, but some not. It's hard to have it. Even some of you who have such a belief may, in some way, it may be sort of part of your split mind, like you may feel it's a kind of spiritual belief and a non-rational belief. Because you were all educated in science classes, where you were assured by authorities that there is no soul and no mind, and because that's a really crucial thing in modern science. The reason they have that is that they were getting burned at the stake by the church for a thousand years or so, so they thought that was kind of a bad deal, and they felt the hold the church had over people was because the people were afraid for their soul. And the church controlled the destiny of their soul, so they had to get rid of the soul, you know. And they fiercely oppose its return, actually. It's like they have, like, in their own inquisition, in American academia at least, and a European as well, I think, in the science departments. And they will not give tenure to someone who looks for a vital principle. In Germany in the 1830s, there was a man named von Helmholtz who was a chemist and was the archenemy of Goethe, who argued that there was a vital principle, a life principle, that science should consider, you know, as well as material things. And he hated him, and he actually created something called the Physicalist's Oath, in English at least, whatever that would be in German. And nobody could get a professorship in a German university who wouldn't sign that Physicalist's Oath. So it's a long-standing sort of parameter of our culture, that even if we think it makes sense in a way in a spiritual thing, we sort of doubt it on a visceral level. And we live, as the Tibetans would say, we live for the purpose of this life. And actually the Tibetan analysis, and also some Japanese Buddhist philosophers, and some others from other countries where Buddhism is still alive, and Japanese in a modern way, some of the great people of the Kyoto school in Japan, for example, they consider the sickness of Western society, which is now global industrial society, has to do with the fact that the people operating the machines and the factories and the war equipment and all the facilities of our society really, at a deep level, consider themselves not being there, not really existing. So they're therefore, in a way, are irresponsible. So the planet, the host planet, is just, you know, so much, it's just stuff to be rearranged to fit our immediate sensory needs. And since there's no soul and no mind, even just a brain, our concern for our own situation stops at death automatically. So we have a kind of negative or boring nirvana waiting for us automatically. And we kind of don't mind the boredom because it's not painful. It won't be painful. It's like we have an assured infinite anesthesia waiting us at death. And then people say, but I care about my children, my grandchildren. Oh, I'm so concerned about them. I love them so much. And of course, people do. But my question always was, once I had a debate with Daniel Dennett about this, and I said, yeah, Dan, you're ethical, you're moral, you like your children, you care for them. And I said, and that's your future life. But how much do you care for them? Are you willing to change the way the society is treating the environment that your children and grandchildren will live in and sacrifice, you know, your Mercedes and your air conditioning and your and the whole thing? And then he said, no. there's no point in practicing Tantra or practicing Buddhism, for that matter, if one has not first used one's critical faculties and overthrown in one's own mind that sense of sort of that one will not exist at a certain point. And even sometimes we disguise from ourselves the fact that that's a way of excusing ourselves, of ratcheting up our level of responsibility for the world and for others and for the environment. We excuse ourselves for that by saying that not existing after death is not something I'm comfortable with. I'm so scared of nothingness. I often like to ask people, like, I can ask you actually, how many of you here are scared of nothingness? Frightened of the abyss, the void, nothing. How many? Oh, you know I'm tricking you. You know, nobody's saying. Usually, so a lot of people go, I'm scared of nothing. They do like that. People do. In a big audience, like, you know, 500 people. Wow, that's fun. Then I say, you know, if Rambo says, I'm scared of nothing, what does that mean? It means he's not scared. So what's the matter with you, you know? That you're scared of nothing. How can you be scared of nothing? Nothing is nothing. It can't do anything to you. It isn't there, actually. Nothing means something is not there, right? There's no there about nothing, right? And therefore, if you realize there's no there about nothing, that also means, this is where you start to put critical leverage against the kind of sense that we have that we're going to escape at death from our problems. Is you realize that nothing cannot be a place you can enter. You know, the trajectory of yourself as a being with momentum, with a mind that has momentum, you know, like energy, it can't enter nothing because it's not a place to receive you. You follow me? It's nothing, it's all nothing right now. And it's all complete illusion. There is no nothing, which is actually the rational thing. And so it's utterly irrational to say I'm scared, to feel scared of nothing. And the being scared is the pretense that one isn't looking forward to it. When I was translating the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was an amazing experience for me, actually, I had not planned to do it. It was a commission. Someone asked me to do it. And then my original guru had said, handed me a copy of it years earlier and saying, you're going to need this. And I said, no, I don't. That's been done. I'm not interested in that. He said, yeah, no, you're really going to need this, he said. And therefore, I translated. But while I was translating it, The Final Exit, the book by Jack Kevorkian, was becoming a bestseller in America. euthanasia, you know. People welcoming what they assumed would be permanent anesthesia, you know, without having to beg for morphine, you know, from their doctors. So, in a way, so the beginning of the exoteric Buddhist path has to do with evaluating yourself as a human being. It isn't really, you know, in the general, there's a general cultural context about reliance on the teaching and the teacher and all this kind of stuff. But really, the real working path of cultivating the spiritual life has to do with evaluating your life, what you are, your meaning of yourself as a human being, and really becoming more, heightening your awareness of how precious an entity you are, which is not an ordinary type of pride or arrogance, or shouldn't lead to that. It should rather lead to a sense of urgency about living your life a certain way. And then if you think about it, you know, the corollary of being nothing after death is, there are two corollaries, but one is that essentially one is nothing now, essentially. Because, for example, if I was about to be blown up in a fire or something and thinking that that was a painful way to die, and I had a gun, I might blow my brains out, thinking that would make me anesthetic permanently. That would be reducing me to what my essence is, which is nothing. So that means we are essentially nothing if we have that view, because we don't have the confidence that we have a mind over matter. We don't really feel that in our culture. It's very difficult, and I shouldn't prejudge. Some of you may really feel that. Your mind, you don't have to bend a spoon, but you may feel that your mind really can shape matter in a certain way. So therefore, your mind has an effective energy as part of nature, and then you're a way step beyond our culture, the materialist culture, the scientifically materialist culture. And the other corollary is, of course, that you were nothing before you became conscious, not at birth, but at a certain time when, you know, Jean Piaget decides you have a sense of individuation at around 4 or 5, I think, in his stages of childhood, you know, or Eric Erickson, those psychologists who study children. So then if that's so, then what kind of creature are you? You just came up to the illusion of having a mind at 4 or 5, and you've nursed that illusion within this life and try to deal with a difficult environment, and you try to make it as pleasant as you can for yourself. And if you're intelligent, you realize it should be pleasant for those with you, as in whatever size circle you have. And then it's all over, and it was ended up, and also that has no meaning, therefore. It's a total accident. It's a random mutation. You're just a product of your parents' genes. And, you know, Richard Dawkins assures that you drop your genes off in some useful place. preferably at Oxford, where he comes from. So the sense of yourself as a precious being is the Buddhist Darwinian view, Buddha's own scientific Darwinian view, which is that, yes, you're a part of a species, and you're part of the evolution of animal life, although they don't believe that this is the only place where there are human life forms in the vast, huge, multi-trillion planet universe. And, you know, therefore, it's just this one bunch of accidents. In infinity, there can be infinite number of accidents producing life. And so instead of that, and it's just, so you are that, you know, your body is genetically adapted to this environment of this planet, and the genes of your parents have coded for it and so forth, and you receive that. But you personally also have evolved in different life forms. And you now achieved a life form. You chose a set of parents. You chose to be human. You entered the womb at that moment, at an auspicious, propitious moment. And you're here with this incredible intelligence. You, all of you, chose to be born in a relatively free country where you had access to education and health and leisure and liberty to learn things. And you encountered teachings from all over the world. You encountered the Buddhist teaching and other religions and philosophies and sciences and so forth. And whatever you learn in this life will affect your future existence. And you have the capacity as a human to shape that future existence to be even better than this one. You know, if you're a good yogi now, you could be a better yogi in another life. You know, if you add the mind, you could, of course, you can't take the well-developed yogi body into the next life, but you can take the mind that knows the form and that aspires to ever greater and greater and more open and more vital and more energized forms. So that makes you immensely precious initially to yourself. It means that your life is an opportunity for yourself. And it's an opportunity, of course, that can be wasted. And like a person who lives by killing some kind of, you know, military or criminal or something, is lowering there because the human being is chose. The human being has a soft skin, no fangs, claws, no decent claws. They break fingernails at the drop of a hat. They have no fangs. We're not that big and strong. You know, we can wrestle a rhinoceros or something. But we invent things because we can speak to each other and we can create and invent and share knowledge over generations and between millions of people. It's amazing what our intelligence can do, and then we can use that to be worse, of course, than a fierce animal. But actually, we chose a life form of a non-fierce animal. Kind of, that's my chicken shit theory of evolution. Rather than the MIT one, you know, the militarist society kind of view that mighty hunter, you know, we're out there in the savannah chasing down the lion, you know, pushing, telling the women to shut up and cook and all this. That's the militarist myth they have. And actually, rather than that, we were that animal that was hiding in a cave while the fierce animals were running around. And then our wives suggested, well, why don't you get a spear, dear? And then we listened and sharp the spear. Okay, well, I was spear. And so we learned things and we talked because we were afraid and we hid, you know. So this is the human, you know, we have this amazing intelligence, you know. And so that's how where the path begins. And so it's a completely life-changing idea where it has a wonderful horizon of potentially infinite positive development. You know, the Dalai Lama is not asking us to go worship the Dalai Lama at all. The Dalai Lama is inviting us to try to be like the Dalai Lama, to develop compassion to an extreme degree ourselves, and even be better than the Dalai Lama. That's what the Dalai Lama is inviting us to do. And he feels equal to all of us, actually. That's part of his thing. That's what compassion means. They feel the feeling of the other person as much as their own, and there are more other people, so they're more concerned for others than bothering with themselves. And then there are degrees, and even greater degrees, and Dalai Lama will be first to say there are greater degrees of being effective at that than he is, although not too much greater, I think, given the circumstances. But I think people will not really realize that until Tibet has become free, by the free choice of the Chinese leadership, where they finally realize that Tibet is their greatest ornament as far as the rest of the world goes. And it's like a $1 trillion public relations bonanza for them to let the Tibetans be free. Of course, the Tibetans themselves, following their leader, they want to be part of China, actually. And they definitely will. Even the ones now who say, I'll never do it, all this, they will want to be when they're being treated well. Because China, you know, they want to help the Chinese because Chinese have wrecked their own country, misled by American industrialization, you know, Western industrialization fantasy of life. What the purpose of life is, produce, you know, and dominate and conquer, you know. That's the purpose of life. You know? Just be a mindless cog in a wheel of mindless self-destruction, actually. That's the purpose of life. And when you die, then it doesn't matter anyway what you did. It was an all accident anyway. And the red, white, and blue flag flies, you know, which we got from the French, you know, the colors. Although red, white, and blue is the color of conception, you know, when you take a life. The red and white seeds of the mother and father and the blue seed of the individual who comes. The evolving individual that you were from all your past lives that decided, hell, I'm going to be human this time. I think those humans are sweet. They do really weird things. They're kind of weird with their funny dangling arms. But, you know, among all the other dirt bags that all the other animals are, they are the most intelligent ones. They can scrub up, actually. I'm referring, of course, to Nagarjuna's little dirt bag exquisition, which is used to control being horny. You know? It's used to conquer horniness. Someone who's like, swept away by lust. It does take a... take a good look at their own body and others' bodies, and they calm down. And very essential for monks and nuns, and also for maybe good family relations to keep things in their place, you know, the raging fires, you know. So that's where it begins. So how about, then you have to think, that's a meditation. So we're now we're meditating on that, because we're supposed to alternate meditating. That's our plan. So meditate a little bit inside yourself and think about what you really think you are. And recognize in some aspects of your worries, you know, the way your thoughts flow, you're kind of really only worrying about this life, what you're responsible for in this life. When you make decisions about should I do this or that, the horizon of the consequences of the decisions stops at death, if you think about death at all, actually. But, you know logically that it does. And so in the light of those potential different options and consequences, you choose what you do in this life. Or not. I mean, you can look at this. The point is, the meditation is to look into your own attitudes, your worldview, as the Buddhists would say, and take a look at that. And then meditate on, even if you sort of generically and habitually, like, I don't believe that stuff, you know, that's all some weird stuff. If you have that reaction, notice that. And then think about, well, if I did think that I've had many, many previous lives, and many of them I've been in much worse shape than I am in this life. Excuse me. And I've had to struggle with, I was much less effective in dealing with my world and my environment. I might have been a deer in the forest or a monkey or something. And somehow I envisioned, or I saw some guy walking around with a gun and a pith helmet, and I thought seemed more powerful than me and more free. And I saw a lot of them, and I saw some females from that species, and I kind of was interested in that. And so I had a dream I was a human, and I kind of enjoyed that feeling, although I didn't really understand it. And then after I died, I kind of woke up as a human. I don't really remember what happened in the between state. Maybe it was sort of like a dream after death. But whatever it was, then I woke up as a human. And so it's just an imagination for us, perhaps, unless someone has actually remembered a little bit of their previous life. And I can say I have, actually. Finally, a few breakthrough, slight glimpses. But very convincing to me. Which is the way one does really become convinced. But also there's a lot of other evidence. It's not just something you're supposed to believe in a blind faith way. Buddha never wants people to believe anything in blind faith way, because blind faith belief is very weak, because it doesn't have a strong reason, it doesn't follow evidence or what seem to be facts, and doesn't critically evaluate them. It actually is consciously believes for no reason. And once you believe something for no reason, you can believe anything equally for no reason. So it's very, very fickle and unstable and not motivating, that kind of faith. And of course, it could be belief in very wrong thing, because there's no reason. So then you have that, so you're meditating that you feel now suddenly, wow, I shaped my human life form now, male or female, young or old, you know, whatever nation, country, race, nationality, ethnicity. I chose this. I made this. My intelligence. You know, you're proud of yourself for whatever you are as a professional or as whatever you learned, your education, whatever you've read. You know, you're proud of having done that because you feel you made that that's kind of understanding and skills that you have in your life. And different things you did, overcoming the emotional problems and things, you're proud of that. So now suddenly you're proud of your actual life form. Meditate that, since you had all these other forms and you picked this one. You had a choice in it. It wasn't a random accident. You picked it. And then, corollary is, what you do now will affect what happens when you have to leave this body. Because it breaks down, you know, at a certain time. Can't last forever. It's a changeable, fluctuating process. And then this continuum of you, you're not sure what that will be, won't have your passport, won't have your name, you won't have your tag. You know, you don't necessarily going to be human again. If, for example, you didn't enjoy this human life in some way, you might think some other one is better. You might imagine that the grass is greener as a horse or something. You never know. But, you know, in any way, whatever is the attitude in your mind about it will shape where you go. So that becomes a little frightening, because you want to know how to do that. How do you shape? How do you shape your life? How do you turn? It sort of gives you a pressure to turn your life into a learning, developing, evolutionary experience. If you meditate on this. And if you have, like, I don't think that, or I don't agree with that, fine. Although you should look critically at what are the reasons you think what you do think. But that's part of this meditation, actually. What evidence do people have who tell you that they know there is no such thing? And how did they learn that? And how did they discover that? Where did they find the nothing that people become? And what made them think that? They notice the body stops functioning, yes. But how did they know that the mind stops functioning? You know, that's the kind of critical thing you meditate. But rather, since we're doing this quickly, rather just imagine that you do begin to have this feeling of fitting into a much longer evolutionary experience consciously, personally, yourself as a person. Not necessarily with your name, and not necessarily only as a human, but yourself as a person, as a continuum of sensitivity and awareness. And how does that affect the way you experience being here? The point of the meditation is that it is truly a life-changing thing to shift one's, it's a huge shift from being sort of just meaninglessly and accidentally here, except for whatever immediate meaning and purpose you choose to be comfortable here and to make your loved ones comfortable. And then with no ultimate consequence of it, to being part of this beginningless and endless chain of continuum of sensitivity and awareness and will. That means that given the infinity of that, you can also become something vastly different from yourself in a positive direction, given infinite time to develop. You know, what Nagarjuna was telling the king was drawn from sort of the Buddhist biological theory that is karma, where he was saying that, you know, your body will have shoulders like this, you know, your hands will be like that, you know, your back will be this way, and then there's certain signs on the face and head and so on. And they have a certain beauty and shape, even everything, and coming from which kinds of deeds. And of course, referring to it being over millions of lifetimes. Just like the theory of evolution, you know, the species develops by genetic adaptation and mutation, random mutation, in response to environment, over millions and millions of generations of those species. So it's a vast thing like that in which you're personally involved, not just some genes that are not you. You personally like that. And they actually have an expression in the Buddhist, which you can translate as the spiritual gene, or the mental gene. So it's not, it's very, very subtle energy shaping and structuring continuum of aware and sensitive that can be shaped, massively transformed, and is massively transformed, just like from a caterpillar to, or an amoeba even, to a human, is this huge, you know, we are a colony of millions of creatures, you know. And a single, simple type cell creature to a human is like an inconceivable evolutionary distance. As, you know, someone like Carl Sagan tells you in his movies. So we can evolve even greater in that direction to Buddhahood, and then they call that Buddhahood. Buddhahood is when you become fully conscious of every piece of reality, of yourself and your environment and other beings, and therefore you can, on the fly, so to speak, shape things to ameliorate people's experience of them in an optimal way. Although you don't have some sort of omnipotent power to completely just, with a wave, just transform everyone. But you have tremendous power to affect them in a positive way, and affect everything and yourself in a positive way. You know, and given the infinity of causation, that the causal process continues infinitely, it has a kind of logical possibility. But it has a danger, too, that goes with it, and Nagarjuna was emphasizing that very much with the king. You can also go in a very, very negative direction into states of ever-increasing horror and pain, since everything is completely changeable. And if you become more and more paranoid, more and more angry and hateful and frightened, and you want more and more isolated from the rest of life and more vicious toward them, but out of fear, then you sort of close in on yourself and you create some sort of self-compression, which ends up being a kind of a crushing existence that he describes in horribly imaginative detail. The Buddha did, actually. In a way, Buddha was the first person to really describe hell, actually. 2,500 years ago, hell was not invented, or human beings didn't think about it before that, in recent cycle of literary history. Probably because they... the sense of individuation was relatively weaker in the older societies, and they just felt they were part of nature, and when they die, they just sort of become fertilizer in the grass, and the next generation kind of grows up with the food. And it's just like an impersonal cycle, another version of an impersonal cycle, like the modern biologists have an impersonal cycle. As I told Dan Dennett, your genes are here in life, but you're not here. You said you discovered Daniel Dennett couldn't continue beyond death, but that you're not even here now. Just the name Daniel Dennett is here. Genetic process is here, but you're not here as a person. Well, I could be at least. He didn't like the implication. Okay, ding. Then you. The point of that meditation was just to give you a kind of experiment on how would your life change if, you know, you develop a kind of mindfulness. That the words you spoke, that the gestures you made, that the thoughts that you thought were going to shape your existence in positive and negative ways, with this sort of no limit to the trajectory, you would become more prudent and cautious and thoughtful about every word or deed or thought even. And being more thoughtful about what you think, of course, is why in Buddhist culture, mastery of one's own mind is the actual, you know, the holy grail, you know. That becomes the primary purpose of life, is to gain control of one's own mind and emotions, rather than gain property or fame or you know, change things about the world. Gain control of oneself becomes the most important thing. So that's first foundation. And then given that foundation, now coming back to relating to the Kala Chakra, given that foundation, then the bodhisattva vow becomes logical. You know, that this illness talks about. Meaning the idea that one wants to devote oneself to the betterment of all other beings in all of one's future lives. what it becomes logical because you're stuck with all other beings, right? Like here we are together in Ladakh for a few days, going to the Kala Chakra. But from the Buddhist point of view, we've already done this a zillion times and in other lives, and we just don't remember. And we're going to keep doing it, and we're going to be in each other's face forever, plus lots of other people. And the best way to, when you're stuck with a bunch of people, what's the best way of being stuck with them? They like you and you like them. It's much nicer than hating each other. How about we all hate each other a lot, you know? That's right. But we can't leave each other. We're stuck with each other. Can't destroy each other. That's the worst way to be. Frightened of everybody else, disliking them all, finding them irritating. You know, it would be impossible to have that view, to feel that way. It's, if you're stuck with them. And therefore, like, you know, in a large city, I used a thing, actually, a lot of my Buddhist teacher colleagues used that, they liked that thing of mine I came up with years ago at a Dalai Lama event in Tucson, actually, where I said, well, it's like you're, when you get into that different way of being embedded in nature, because you've had, you adopt a multi-life perspective where it slowly becomes common sense to you, then suddenly it's like, and of course, this is especially good for New Yorkers, but if you're also urban people, I don't think, they don't have a subway in Tucson, I don't think so. So, you know, cities with subways, you're forced to get together with a bunch of strangers, and or a bus, you know. And so, and you do, and then there's this kind of thing in that situation where, you know, you don't really look at these other people particularly. If you look too hard at some of them, they might think you're weird and you get in a problem. If they look at you hard, you get nervous and you get deep in your book or newspaper or start reading the commercials on the ceiling. If you don't happen to have a book or look at your iPhone. And so, because you have this concept that you're going to get out and you might sort of hope they don't follow you and they're going to get out and you're never going to have anything more to do with them. But then the fantasy is that the sort of James Bond thing, the subway is suddenly shunted to a side thing, the door is slammed down, and the voice of Henry Kissinger comes on the thing saying, this is going to be a national security experiment to see what you do when closed in a small space forever. And we will not there, we will bring food and there's a bathroom here and blah, blah, blah. And then first you pound on the glass and, you know, but it's impregnable and you can't get out. And then whenever it settles in that the people realize that they can't get out, they suddenly start looking at everybody else in the subway. Who's could be a friend? Who could be a problem? How can I deal with them? If somebody starts freaking out, everybody tries to soothe them down. If somebody gets angry at the freaking out person, everybody shuts up the person who's getting angry, etc. It suddenly becomes a community and the other people become important to you who you absolutely were going to get away from the minute before. So it's an analogy of this shift about the life that is the Buddhist worldview of the nature of life, of biology, that we are beings in a flow together, a life flow together, and we'll always be together, actually. So then the optimal way of always being together is to love each other, to love and be loved. That's the obvious way, you know, because when you love someone, then you don't wish them anything unpleasant. And when they love you, they don't wish you anything unpleasant. And it's also huge. It's a mathematical, marvelous thing. Because, for example, otherwise, in the normal egotistical scene, you're looking out for yourself. And you're assuming that's what they're doing. And every bodhisattva for himself, as a friend of mine used to say, when he comes to the buffet, you know. And so this one puny person is looking out for you. So then, if you love everybody else and they all love you, which is what they call a Buddha land, then you're sort of more concerned with them. You want them all to be happy. But then you have hundreds of people wanting you to be happy. You have all these good vibes from all these people. And I sometimes think of it, my other analogy for it is a John Belushi food fight universe, where everybody has a big bowl of mousse au chocolat or whatever thing they think is delicious. And normally you look nervously and see if there's enough for everybody to go get yours. don't want to be the last in line. And in this case, you want everybody else to have your dessert. So everybody starts throwing the dessert at each other. Then everyone's all smeared with it. It's really fun. There is actually a Buddha land of pure food. Like there's a Buddha land of pure light. There are such things. The Buddhist literature has these amazing sort of sci-fi ideas. They really do. There's a Buddha land in the Vimalakirti Sutra. There's a Buddha land of pure incense, where the Bodhisattvas' bodies are made of incense. The ground is made of incense. The Buddha is made of incense. The trees are incense. And the Dharma is not taught by words, but the Buddha just radiates a certain scent, and the Bodhisattvas are sitting under their incense trees, and they inhale the scent as they're meditating, and they go into like millions of samadhis and things like that. And it's called Sugandha, Paraganda, Sarvaganda Sugandha. And it comes up in the treatise because Vimalakirti sends out an emanated duplicate of himself for takeout from that universe. And he brings some incense rice back from the Buddha as a blessing to this world. And then to feed, because Vimalakirti has to feed thousands of people in his house, and which he does magically from these few grains of rice, you know. But then the Bodhisattvas in the incense universe, they're like, they're so bored, their samadhis and their incense. And they say to the Buddha, what kind of world is the planet Saha, where Shakyamuni lives, and Vimalakirti lives, who would send for takeout to our universe across the galaxy? And we want to go see that. Can we go see that? Yeah, you guys have, you know, teleportation powers. You can go and see it if you like. But if you go to the earth of Shakyamuni, you have to change your incense bodies into a coarser form. Because if you go there smelling like that, those people are going to go insane. They can't imagine a smell so ecstatic and beautiful as yours. So don't go there. You have to change your body when you reach there. And then the Bodhisattvas come to this thing. And when they get to our planet, they go, woo! What kind of Buddha is this? What kind of planet does he have? Then there's an argument about this is a better planet because there's more compassion here. Less samadhis, less good facilities for samadhi, but more facilities for developing compassion. Anyway, that's the marvelous imagination of the Buddhist. So the first preparation for Tantra is combination of realizing the preciousness of your life, deciding that you are going to getting what's called realistic worldview, and deciding you are going to make your life meaningful as you are an evolutionary continuum, and you're going to see to it that your lives are going to be better and better, and you're going to be able to do more and more for those you love. You know, even next life, because they're going to die and be reborn, you're going to die and be reborn. You're going to, you're going to really go for maximum positive development and evolution in your life. And you make that kind of decision. Then you add to that deep meditation. Let's meditate again. We're going to have another short meditation, okay? Go back into meditative mode. Don't look at me. Don't write notes. Think inside yourself. The next meditation for this first prerequisite is meditating on death. Not in general, but on specifically on your own death. And it's said to have three roots, the liberative meditating on death. And the first root is meditating on the fact that you surely are going to die. The certainty that you're going to die. And then your mind protests when you meditate on that. And sort of imagine that happening. It protests and says, I don't need to do that. I know I'm going to die. And then you realize, again, always these meditations, are, this kind of meditation is critical. Then you realize that actually you keep living, you keep acting like you're always going to live. Yeah, I'll do the other thing next year. Oh, yeah, 3 years from now I'll do that. After I retire, I'll do the other. Oh, yeah, I'll do. It sort of goes on without counting up the numbers. So we kind of act like we're going to be just the same as we are now forever. When pressed, we'll say, oh, yeah, my body will change. I'll get decrepit. Of course, everybody dies, I know, but we never imagined that we are going to die. And dying, of course, means, we don't even know quite what it means, actually. Scientists don't know what death means. But Buddhists have it. Buddhist scientists do. But But it means leaving, our awareness will leave the body one way or another. Body will no longer be our residence, you can say. So meditate on the sureness that you're going to die. Eat your cookie later. Then the second root of meditating on death is meditate on the uncertainty of when that will be. After this trip, of course. Can happen anytime. Sometimes, sadly, the young die before the old. The healthy die before the sick. The safe die before the ones in danger. There's no accidents can happen anytime. We really don't know when it will be. And now that we've contemplated the first route, and we're feeling sure that we're going to, and then the fact that we don't know, then this ratchets up the intensity of our moment, using every moment, and being more alive and vital and vast in every moment, intensifies it. And then the third route of meditation on death is, when I do die, in case the Buddha Darwin, was right, and a continuum of my awareness will continue past the cessation of my body, then that will be a very subtle process. And whatever I have encoded in my consciousness continuum, in my spiritual gene, that is what will go with me. That's the only thing I can take with me. So then, meditating on that makes one, that one then causes one to reflect. How much of my daily time, weekly, monthly, yearly, do I actually devote to shaping my mind? If at all. Or if I just get dragged around by my mind, its desires, its aversions, its hatreds, its envies, its dissatisfactions, its puzzlements and confusions. How much time do I devote in being A, totally mindful of that sort of thing, and less enslaved by it? Solomon said we're enslaved to our emotions. He said that today. We think we're these free people, live in free country, but then we're enslaved by our emotions. It really means enslaved by the emotions. And therefore, this will cause one, when one meditates on this, which you are now doing, to reevaluate your priorities, how you spend your time. And then the third thing, still in this first preliminary, which Nagarjuna also touched on in talking to the king, is actually the prescription of how to shape your life. And this relates to a kind of, you could call it a secular ethics. If you see karma as a mental Darwinian theory, or a Darwinian theory that includes the mind with the body, it doesn't neglect the body, but it includes the mind with the body, not just the genes, though. It's mental gene and physical gene, both working together, then how you shape it becomes a system of ethics. So that, like the secular ethics that His Holiness promotes in the terms of the materialist secular worldview, to try to stimulate people to make more ethical, live more ethically, therefore more happily. And this is a brilliant thing. You know, he kept the translator, you may remember, he kept talking about the tenfold path of virtue and tenfold path of non-virtue. And this word, gewa in Tibetan and kushala in Sanskrit, is translated as virtue by translators usually. But it actually is, it's a Sanskrit word, actually means skill. So ethics becomes a matter of skill. Why would it be called skill? Evolutionary skill is why. And take the first one. The first of the tenfold path is killing, taking life, or saving life. And why is it more skillful to save life in this Buddhist evolutionary view than to take life? When you take a life, you're depriving another being of their body, of their embodiment. You're not destroying their mind or soul, you cannot. It leaves the body and goes on. But you are depriving them of their body. And so you're saying, and their life, and that in that body. And so you're saying, your act is a statement, I'm not connected to your life. My life doesn't need your life. In fact, it needs you not to have your life. So your life is separate from me. So it's unskillful because it intensifies the illusion of our individual separateness from the rest of the universe. And we shrink ourselves into greater separation because we're just not into those lives, because we can use them and take them. When we save a life, we embrace the life. We say, I am connected to your life, and I want you to keep it. And, you know, I'm helping you to keep it. And isn't that wonderful? And so your life is an extension of my life. So my life increases. If you see the summit of evolution of Buddhahood, and Buddhahood is defined as where you become a being who feels like you are all the other beings' lives. And therefore you automatically want them to be good. You want them to be happy. You want them to feel bliss. You want them to be wise. You want every good thing for them. Total good you want. You love them. So therefore, when you save a life, you skillfully expand your being toward that Buddhahood. Even if it's a tiny little thing. You know, you just save a bug instead of squashing it. Okay, that bug's life is part of your world then. It wasn't you crushed it on the illusion that you got it out of your world. And then stealing, and then sexual misconduct or abuse. And those are the three physical. And then lying and slandering to create division among other people. Speaking harshly and speaking meaninglessly. A form of speech. And then having a greedy mind, coveting other people's things. Sort of mental stealing. Having a malicious mind, mental killing. And then having a deluded mind, you know. Of just not knowing what you are, you know, and what's real and what's unreal. Those are tenfold things, and all of them, those that expand your sense of life and connect you to a larger life, are skillful, and those that shrink you away from a larger life and narrow your life, compress you more in your separateness, are unskillful. It's really very marvelous and brilliant. So anyway, but when you see that and you realize how hard that is, including mental, you know, again, then the mindfulness and meditation becomes important because mentally one reacts with sort of jealousy and, you know, to things, to others, for fortune and success. One feels a little jealous, you know, one feels irritated with something that somebody did, et cetera. One is just generally confused and deluded also. And so it's you know, stop meditating now. Bing, you can eat your cookie. I'm sorry, your coffee was getting cold. And I'll keep talking, though. So that's the third thing. And then the fourth thing is the basic evaluation of the life of the person who feels separate from everything else. And this is the Buddha's first noble truth. Connects to the first noble truth. Because if I'm just me, separate from everything else, however I define myself, then I, in situations of stress, everything else is against me. And I'm against everything and, of course, everyone else. And if I'm against everything and everyone else, who wins? I sure don't. No one can take on the universe. Even W couldn't take it on. He thought he would be president. He'd be the master of the universe. But poor guy. He's like, he's in hospital. But he does good things, painting a portrait of his dog. That's really, no, that's very good. It's like connecting to the life of his dog. He was annoyed with the dog when he was interviewed by Barbara Walters. Because he told the dog, come here, Scotty, or whatever the name was. The dog just said, screw you, you're invading Iraq. I don't want to talk to you. The dog is like heading off, taking off. So the basic state of, so the idea is, this fourth thing is that as long as I feel disconnected from the universe, and essentially, I will be dissatisfied. And even I'm, you know, a god in a pleasure palace in the heaven of Tushita or someplace, I'm still against the rest of the world. And then there's time. And then even gods age and die, although long lives, they have really much longer lives. And or even sort of a god among humans, you know, some kind of like a president or whatever it is, you know, famous person, wealthy person. Still, the basic thing of self versus the rest is hopeless. So either life is suffering, but then Buddha's discovery based on that was that the root of that is a delusion about the nature of one's relationship to the world. And that delusion is the egotistical delusion that I have a separate essence from everything else. And my essence is not interconnected with everything else. I have inherent existence or intrinsic reality or all these terms that I have absolute self that is completely and absolutely different from other. That's the root of the problem, and from that comes an overwhelming desire to possess more, to expand the dominion of myself, and also a fear and hatred of others wanting to have dominion over my absolutely separate self, greed and hatred, you know. But those things can be overcome by realistic understanding, by wisdom, and that's why His Holiness was harping so much in between giving the loan and reading the text. And Nagarjuna's harping so much on knowledge of emptiness. But I'm jumping ahead anyway. So the point is, at this point, preciousness of your human life because of your infinity as a being, actually. Forget about you being a limited being. You're an infinite being, every single one of you. And you're going to continue. That means you're not going to cease to be. So that gives you, it's like, it was difficult enough. Poor Brent, my friend and partner there, he arranged something for us for six, seven, 8 days. You have to arrange an infinite future. That's not geographic expeditions, it's infinity expeditions. That could drive a person crazy.